Spark Media presents Cosmic Creatures by Jason Kent Nord. Performed for you by Adam Anagnostu, Mike Kelly, John Yonker, and Luke Langfeld. Sound design by Dan Steffens. This episode contains content that may be alarming to some listeners. Please check the episode notes for more detailed descriptions. And now, Episode 8, Luminescence.
As we motor along the tree-lined road out of the subdivision, the diminishing daylight deepens the shadows of the forest, making everything just a little harder to see. On edge, my eyes are peeled for any strange creature that may show itself. After her rough start, Ellie is taking it pretty slow. But I'm not going to say anything. It's already stressful enough. "So slow," moans Fitch. "You drive like a girl." "Because I am one," Ellie retorts. "There's a reason we live longer." Leave it to Fitch to blabber and antagonize. And Ellie isn't one to let such a remark go unchallenged. I've always admired her confidence. She shoots Fitch a seething glare in the rearview mirror. "Just shut up, Fitch," I jump in. "Let her drive." Fitch doesn't seem to notice Ellie. He's too busy nasally mimicking me like a 4-year-old. "Nah, nah, nah." I turn in my seat to see if I can lash out at him. For all his blustering bravado, he's the type who cowers away from any physical confrontation. Which is never my thing to initiate, but Fitch has that way of drawing out the worst in me. He's probably the only human on the whole planet I want to punch. Unfortunately, it would take too much effort. So I just flip him off. His antagonistic instincts kick in, and he leans forward and slaps the top of my head over the headrest. Now I really twist in my seat, needing to retaliate. "Knock it off, guys," Nick orders, annoyed that he's been distracted from surveilling both his surroundings and his thoughts. As he looks toward me, his eyes widen. "Look out!" he calls to Ellie, who has been distracted by our squabbling. I spin back around and see the freaky pink fox frozen in the road ahead. Its eye shine triggers me back in time. The blinding reflection of headlights in the deer's eyes, echoes of my father's hearty laugh and my mother's loving gaze toward him. A curse from Ellie and a jerk of the wheel slams me back to the present. She swerves to the right, just as the fox flees in the same direction. We clip the poor creature pretty forcefully, and Ellie freaks out, swerving hard back to the left, veering across the road and straight toward the trees. She brakes too late. As her foot slams down, we skid the final few feet and slam head-on into a tree. Even at our slow speed, the force of our huge tank meeting an immovable object packs a surprising jolt. Through the windshield, I watch steam pour out from under the hood. As stunned as I am, I turn to Ellie to see if she's okay. She turns to me, horrified and in shock, but mostly exuding an apologetic air of, "Oh my God, I didn't mean to." Without words, we note that neither of us seems to be injured. And then, Ellie's eyes fill with a different worry. She turns, but not toward Fitch or Nick. She's trying to locate the creature. We all open our doors and spill out onto the roadside, muttering some curses. Out of the vehicle, I smell fluids leaking onto a hot engine. Blech, it's a sickening smell that matches how I feel. "Everybody okay?" Nick belatedly queries. Not really expecting any of us aren't. No one answers him. I turn and spy the pinkish lump of fur across the road behind us. We all silently assemble in the middle of the road behind the vehicle, all beholding the poor thing lying there a few yards away. Ellie tentatively approaches the creature. "Stay away from it," Fitch fearfully warns. Ellie stands over it, hands over her mouth, and eyes turning glassy. I see her bottom lip tremble ever so slightly, and I wander over to her side, as does Nick. The animal is obviously critically wounded and lying still. I think it might be dead, but I'm not sure. As amazingly unique as this thing is, I'm a little too skittish after our other encounters to dare move any closer to examine it. In my memories of visiting its planet, this was always the one creature that stood out to me. Maybe it's the pink color, or the sleek profile that made such an impression on me. I guess it's not actually a fox, but its size, puffy tail, and overall shape make me draw the comparison. Its ears are flat, petite flaps of fur. Its torso, like its tail, is almond-shaped. Its head shares a similar profile in reverse. The snout is where it really gets strange. It extends in a way that resembles an anteater. As a whole, it's... well, it's beautiful. Ellie is devastated. I don't know what to say, so I put a comforting hand on her shoulder. She doesn't seem to mind, but I withdraw it after a moment anyway.
Having shed our hazmat suits and initial frustrations, Dr. Mintz and I redirect our focus to the task at hand. Trapped in here, I can't help but feel a sense of dread, like I've fallen into the lion enclosure at the zoo. Taking a long, deep breath, I urge myself to quell the emotions and focus. The overwhelming abundance of unique flora looms all around us, dangling near our shoulders and reaching up to our knees. I've left a lab and entered a very bizarre and colorful jungle. It's strange and peculiar to engage in scientific discovery outside the sterility of a lab setting. Field studies have never been my forte. My role has always been to impartially observe, adhere to meticulous procedures, temper expectations, and reserve emotions for after the conclusions. But this, I feel like I'm in a life-sized petri dish, and my life hangs on specific outcomes. The anxiety is an unwelcome intruder. "Alpha male asshole," mutters Dr. Mintz, perhaps choosing to cling to anger over anxiety. I pick up the portable bioscanner and turn it on. It buzzes as it detects the multitude of biological wonders that surround us. As much as I'd prefer to analyze every fascinating new specimen around me, the creatures take precedence. I focus on calibrating the device to amplify motion detection and heat signatures while dialing back on everything else to hopefully cut through the thick flora. During our debate over incorporating motion detection features into the design of the biological scanning equipment, I was originally opposed. We obviously never imagined encountering anything beyond the microscopic organisms, but Dr. Gibbs, a former colleague, argued that microscopic organisms could become airborne, which means we need a way to detect their presence. Microscopic motion detection seemed like a foolish endeavor and a waste of resources to me, and I was largely vindicated when advancing motion detection capabilities at a microscopic level proved to be an insurmountable distraction. I ultimately relented to incorporating the limited capabilities we had into the scanners to help save face for Dr. Gibbs. But he ended up leaving nonetheless. Now that charitable decision has proven critically important in detecting the motions of unexpected larger creatures. If we survive this ordeal, I'll buy Dr. Gibbs dinner someday. A suffocating, ominous dread falls over me for realizing that, at some point, people will be finding out about this. I fear it won't be a story of discovery, but rather one of calamity. "I don't hear anything," Dr. Mintz notes, refocusing my attention to potential lurking dangers. I can't let these emotions consume me. It's time to get down to business. "Let's move in a grid. Left to right, then forward," I say, gesturing. "Start along the wall and keep the area behind us clear." "Why? So we can escape through the sealed exit?" I sigh. She's right. "We can only control what we can control," I respond. "Let's see what happens." I'm not comforted either, but what else can I say? The scanner has two screens. One displays the infrared measurements, ranging from the blues and greens of lower temperatures to the reds, yellows, and whites of hotter temperatures. Currently, everything is a cool dark blue, except the white-hot circles that represent Dr. Mintz and I. The cooler temperature profiles on the scanner reassure me that there's nothing too sinister near us. Then again, maybe these creatures have body temperatures that blend with their surroundings. It seems unlikely based on the biota of our planet, but all bets are off when it comes to a new world. The other screen displays 3D composites of detected objects, flanked by a bevy of measurements about them. It's based mostly on LIDAR and algorithmic technology working in conjunction, but there are also radar and infrared components that work too. I set a temperature filter to capture only those objects with a plus or minus 5-degree range, and only our images display. I blush a bit at seeing how specifically it detects our body shapes. In my defense, the increased overtime this year has hurt my workout routine. Adjusting the dial to ramp up the reliance on the LIDAR readings, our images thankfully become clothed. Dr. Mintz, ever observant, had been watching. She shoots me an awkward raise of the brow, and my cheeks grow warm. To move on, I remark, I'm not sure that I'm hoping that this picks up anything besides us. From what we saw in the scans, I'm hoping we're alone, she says, holding the gun at the ready. But it would be better for everyone if we're not. The environment around us is bewildering. Instead of an abundance of green leaves or reeds like on Earth, the most common flora here has trapezoidal stalks, teardrop bulbs, and whispery strings. Purples, blues, reds, oranges, and yellows prevail. Each plant seems to have striations of multiple colors in peculiar patterns, rather than singular uniform shades. Even the spongy soil is tinged with orange and purple. It reminds me of an explosion of tacky 1980s fashions, but in a far more artful and elegant master design. Dr. Mintz and I stand there like our feet are stuck in a marsh. Our arms and legs are tucked in, and we resist movement as if surrounded by arrays of spider webs. Deciding to take the first forward pace, I'm greatly surprised as the strings hanging on the nearest tall plant, about 4 feet taller than me, begin to reach out to me as if static attraction is taking effect. Hey, check this out, I share, but Dr. Mintz already sees what's happening. It's too human in here for static, she muses. It couldn't be behavioral, right? I wrap my mind around the possibility of it being pseudo-intelligent behavior. Maybe it's more akin to Thigma nasty in some plants, like how Venus flytraps react to touch or vibration. I'm hesitant to allow it to touch me. Still, curiosity prevails, and I inch my arm closer. The thread-like tendrils reach closer in a wiggling movement that rules out static as an explanation. I can't help myself. I inch closer and closer and... I momentarily lose my mind, panicking as I try to decipher the threat. Dr. Mintz extends the gun, panning the room, ready to fire. The radio crackles and Colonel Harstead's voice explains.
Easy there, Docs. Looks like a tree fell over 10 paces ahead of you.
Dr. Mintz whispers frantically.
Yeah, but why? Could something have pushed it over?
Nothing shows on either screen other than our own images. I reassure myself that we're overreacting, trying to let the adrenaline flush away. I'm not going to stand here all day being afraid. I take a step forward into the brushing of strings. My goosebumps amp up a degree, but there's no pain, scarring, inflammation, or other sign of immediate danger. If I have some kind of reaction, so be it. This is my responsibility. I have to bear the consequences. Still, nothing changes on the screens. I take a second and third step, coming clear of the strings of the first plant. The next two tall plants that flank me behave in the opposite manner, their strings curving away from my presence. At my feet, shorter stems with bulbs slowly roll along the soil in a circle. I move my foot into the arc of one, and it crosses right over my shoe. I check my screen. The calm motion of these short plants registers as grainy static, popping up and then cutting out. If I dialed up the motion sensitivity, I'm sure they would register as better images. But I'm more concerned about seeing the bigger creatures with more aggressive movements without them being muddled by depictions of everything around me. The uneasiness of the activity at my feet urges me forward. Dr. Mintz hurries past the touchy strings behind me. I take 4 more spirited paces toward the sound of the fallen plant, my eyes fervently switching between the screens and the environment before me. 2 more touchy plants lean into me. As I get past them, the next 2 avoid contact. Then I see it ahead. The fallen tree has spiral roots that end at a clean cut, beneath which a patch of the room's smooth flooring is exposed. Of course, I announce, they left their roots at home. To demonstrate, I reach out to the thickest trunk next to me and give it a push. It crashes to the ground, and as it does, its strings reach out furiously in all directions. For a moment, I feel guilty. While plants on Earth are living things, we generally don't regard them the same as we do animals. Perhaps these plants are sentient and deserve a new paradigm of consideration. It's fascinating and hard to process. The scope of samples and discovery that this room holds begins to overwhelm me with excitement, an excitement attached to the fear that Colonel Harstead may destroy it all, or that it might ultimately kill me via some microscopic threat that my body's immune system is incapable of handling. Dr. Mintz joins me, and her curiosity seems to be on the same wavelength. She crouches down and runs a finger along the film left on the exposed floor.
I wish we could dive into acidity tests and get this stuff under a microscope.
The radio crackles again with Colonel Harstead's voice.
Let's finish that scan before we admire God's wonders, Docs.
We both turn to scowl up at the window to the control room, where our single-minded antagonist stands gawking from his safe perch. I grab the radio and politely respond, "Fuck off!" I then turn to Dr. Mintz with great determination.
Let's get this over with. We're either dead or we're not.
It's dead, guys, Fitch announces indelicately from the safety of some distance. Ellie, Nick, and I are less sure, and we inch closer to the fox-like creature. She killed it. And I, for one, am glad, he continues. Ellie ignores him and crouches down to get a close look. Nick and I follow her lead.
Oh, you poor thing, she coos mournfully. I'm so, so sorry.
She covers her face. I hear the sniffles, but don't sense that she's full on crying. Nick and I stare at each other, wondering what we should say, if anything. It's not your fault, I try. We distracted you.
It ain't my fault, fires Fitch, either hopelessly incapable of reading the room or too much of a jerk to care about anyone else's emotions. She was the one driving, and you're the one who brought these things here. Man, I want to punch him.
But I squash that impulse, concerned more for Ellie. Hey, guys, Nick says. Is it, glowing? I look back, and Ellie drops her hands to see what he's talking about. Her glossy eyes grow wide. With the increasing darkness falling upon us, the funky thing sure seems to be giving off a pink, luminescent glow. Fitch wanders closer for a better view, but keeps us between him and the creature.
Is it radioactive or something? He asks.
No, I don't think it's radioactive isotopes, I instantly conclude. It's more likely a heterocyclic compound or luciferin. Biochemistry has always been fascinating to me. It's not physics, but beats the hell out of geology.
Lucifer? Fitch blurts.
Yeah, because a devil beast is so much better than a radioactive one. No! Luciferin. Certain molecules react to emit light, usually catalyzed by the enzyme luciferase, but sometimes through a chemical reaction with photoproteins. There are lots of examples on Earth. Fireflies, snails, bacteria, fish. There's selenterazine, dinoflagellates, and vargulin. But, you know, it's probably something new. Nick and Ellie stare at me. Either impressed, stupefied, or both.
Yeah, probably. Nerd boy. We get it. Stuff glows.
I think it's still alive, Nick offers. That would make sense. I wouldn't really expect such a process to continue in a deceased host. As we stare at the creature, it twitches a bit.
It's suffering, Ellie murmurs.
What do we do?
Just kill the damn thing, votes Fitch. Put it out of its misery.
You ass,
Ellie fires back.
Fine. Give it mouth to mouth, then, Fitch counters. Or, hell, stand there and watch it suffer.
He turns away and mutters, like I'm the ass. He's got a point, Nick concedes. We should do the humane thing, and Brush moves in front of us. Something is approaching through the trees. An ashy violet glow is growing brighter in the grass ahead. Nick, Ellie, and I are up and retreating several paces backward toward the station wagon. Two of the super squirrel critters that I saw at the lab emerge from the grass, each the size of a rabbit. They scurry toward the fox. Starting at its neck, they waste no time and begin to tear at its furry hide. We stand there, mortified.
Nasty,
exclaims Fitch. Nick gives me a, we've got to do something, and fast, look. He spins and jogs to the car. He quickly reaches inside and pulls out the BB gun. I can get them, he says. But his intentions make me uneasy.
Fitch, appearing jealous of the weapon, scurries to the car and retrieves the baseball bat.
No, guys,
frets Ellie. She's clearly seen enough cruelty, and even though their devouring of the freaky fox is troubling to all of us, she's not interested in killing the squirrel things. They're pretty small, I muse aloud. Let's trap them in the car. To hell with that, Fitch objects. But why? Nick says. I mean, I could easily get them. I barely pay attention to him as I look around. In order to get them into the car, I need a ramp or something for them to run up. I spot a chunk of rotting bark lying by a log that's long enough. That'll work. I proceed to stealthily retrieve it, then bring it over and set it in place in the door that Nick left open. It's a perfect ramp. I look to the others for their reactions. Ellie is nodding affirmatively, while Nick stands there, unmoving. Fitch is oblivious and staring at the gory feast. Kale, Nick starts to object.
No, let him, counters Ellie. We can't go around killing things if there is a better way.
I assess my trap for any possible weaknesses and notice the radio on the seat. I retrieve it as I finish visualizing my plan. No open windows, not leaving anything behind. The car's useless in this state to us anyway. Okay, everyone, get behind the car, I instruct. Turning to Fitch, I reluctantly hand him the radio. And I mean reluctantly. With deliberate steps, I advance slowly toward the voracious scoundrels. I assume they won't appreciate any interference with their meal and might defend it. Yet I'm also betting they'll have a fright reflex to a much bigger predator like me. I need to be big and loud. But first, I need to be close enough to make a move. One spots me getting closer and it stops to growl and chirp in my direction. I inch closer, eyeing Freaky Fox's rear leg. They both growl and chirp, rising to face me for a moment until their need to feed drops them back into their dinner. I brace myself. I'm close enough. I breathe to myself. I can do this. Ah! I roar loudly and rocket my hands up, making myself as big as possible. I'm both ready to pounce or flee, depending on their reaction. As hoped, they scatter backward a few feet, and I lunge as quickly as possible to grab the fox's hind leg. It's lighter and much softer than I expected. Or maybe it's the juices flowing. But either way, I'm off with it, dragging it behind me until I'm at the car, where I stop to fling it through the open car door, careful not to knock the ramp out of place. The only quickly accessible safe place for me is the top of the vehicle. I'm nowhere near the athlete that Nick is, but I've done my share of jumping among boulders in the woods over the last decade. Using the back seat and open door as steps, all the while waiting to feel teeth sink into my heels, I swiftly and smoothly hop onto the vehicle's roof. I'm relieved to see the super squirrels returning to the road from where they had fled. They look about for their meal, dashing forward a few feet at a time. They hesitate at the vehicle and begin feverishly growling and chirping up at me, rising up on their hindquarters to do so. Soon, one works up the courage and, oh crap, launches onto the top of the open door, clearly not needing a ramp. It scolds me with growls and chirps. Before I completely crap my pants, it looks down and springs into the back seat. The other one bypasses terrorizing me and leaps straight into the back seat for its meal. I hop down behind the door and slam it. It doesn't immediately shut because busted shards of the brittle bark ramp get in the way. I quickly pull the door open a couple inches, kick the bark away, and re-slam the door. I'm just in time, too, as the small thuds of the jumping buggers hit the closed door inside. The caged rodents go postal, scurry around throughout the inside of the wagon, furiously wanting out. Their claws scratch the windows, dash, and seats. It's a display that makes me realize that what I just did was really stupid. These things are vicious. And yet I did it. I feel good about it. I look to Nick and Ellie for their reactions. Although similarly stunned by the little devils, Ellie gives me an approving smile. And Nick's reaction is not so much approval as it is purely impressed. Wow, that's a new one for me. For the first time in a long time, I actually feel a little confident.
Great, scoffs Fitch. Now how are we going to get into town?
Oh, were you going to fix the radiator? I counter. Fitch sneers and contemplates a comeback.
Better crack a window, he says. Wouldn't want your precious pets to get a heat stroke. I can't help but roll my eyes. Well played, Fitch.
We hope you've enjoyed Cosmic Creatures, a Spark Media production. This program was directed and executive produced by H.G. Zeisler, featuring the voice talents of Adam Anagnostou as Cale Rhodes, Mike Kelly as Russell Rhodes, John Yonker as Dr. Elliot Hagen, and Luke Langfelt as Major Roggie. Text copyright 2022 by Jason Kent Nord. Illustrations including cover and episode art by Meredith Tuvey. Sound design by Dan Steffens. Story edits by Emily Nord and H.G. Zeisler. A special thanks to our founding Spark storytellers. Rest assured that no animals, cosmic or earthly, were harmed in the production of this episode. Enjoyed what you heard? Check out more Spark stories and find out more about Spark Media on our website, sparkmedia.com. That's sparkmedia.com. Or check us out on Instagram or Facebook at Spark Media. Links in episode notes. Interested in telling stories? Apply to be a Spark storyteller today. We're looking for writers, editors, composers, voice talent, and more. It takes a village to tell a story, and we need you. Link in episode notes. Audio production copyright 2024 by Spark Media LLC, all rights reserved.